What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Guy Swan, the host of Bitcoin Audible, Guy's Chats, Guy's Takes, and the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anyone else. I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on the show. How are you?
Yeah, man, doing great.
That's awesome.
Doing great. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. Things are busy, but I'm really excited to get into this. You know, it's interesting. I came to Bitcoin in 2017. I probably came for the gains, and I stayed for the monetary policy, the finite supply, and the Austrian economics. And, you know, but in between that, I did get excited about the tech. And I mm-hmm. thought a lot about it as technology. And I consider myself sort of like, you know, the front end of being a user of technology, but I'm not necessarily someone who's going to, you know, get under the hood and rip everything apart or write code. But, you know, so I got really excited about the technology. But after a while, when I moved on to those other subjects and those other rabbit holes, and those are what kept me, I kind of like stopped looking at the tech so closely. And I'm excited about it, but I didn't want to get amped about it and get impatient about it. And I love where Bitcoin just is now. I would be satisfied if everyone put their pencils down and we just rocked it as is.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you know, I want to, you know, maybe I won't use these things tomorrow, but I kind of want to see what's coming down the road. I want to see around the corners and get a little more insight into this. So, I mean, it's in your Twitter handle, Guy Swan, Taproot 2020. What is Taproot?
Okay, so going from the tech side, it's funny, you know, I talk about this actually quite a bit, that Bitcoin is not, I mean, despite the fact that it is a fascinating system, like the architecture as a network is brilliant and unbelievably unique, all of the tech inside of it is really old. In fact, that's a lot of what makes it work, is that it's all insanely secure, tested, like beaten to death tech. You know, it used an old, like SHA-256 was one of the oldest, most reliable, like cryptographic algorithms. Like he went with reliable. And that was kind of like at the heart of it. So it's been kind of interesting, like from a development. I mean, I'm not a developer myself, but I follow it really closely. I'm always reading the newsletter and Bitcoin OpTech and, you know, all that stuff. I try to stay really up on it just so I can explain it to people on the show. There's something that Andrew Polstra said that I thought was really funny, is that from just an idea of like cryptography, like if you like talked to cryptographers and people who are like coding up new things, if you basically gave them the restriction to create new cryptographic tools where the only output that you are allowed to have is a signature, and the only input you're allowed to have is basically a key, he said that would sound like the absolutely most insane set of restrictions that you could come up with.
Right.
He says, and that's basically the environment that they have to develop in.
Right.
That the only output can be a signature. So that's kind of where the magic of Taproot is. So it actually does, the reason it requires a salt fork is because it's a new signature scheme. Like it's a new method of writing the signature in a sense for the transaction.
Right. Well, what is a soft fork versus a hard fork?
Okay. Soft fork is, yeah. So this is a consensus system, which means that everybody's playing by the same rules, and that's why we're on the same network. Like the only reason we're talking right now is because we're both using TCP/IP on the exact same version.
Right.
If you just started adding a whole bunch of random numbers into your IP address because it was some new standard, we wouldn't be able to talk to each other anymore. That's kind of a hard fork. It's changing the code of Bitcoin so that the current Bitcoin network doesn't talk with the new software.
Right. And so I guess a soft fork is backwards compatible.
Exactly. PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. You can play all PlayStation 2 and 1 games on the PlayStation 3. Backwards compatible.
Right.
There is new stuff, but all the old stuff works.
Got it.
So that's the signature scheme, and it's a soft fork. And basically what it does is it's three major benefits in like my mind. One of them is space savings. When currently, like if you have like a multi-signature,
right,
you've got, you know, you need a key and you need to sign. I have a key I need to sign, and person three, a lawyer or a betting company or something, has to sign. And it's a two of three. Well, to write that transaction, we need to show that all three are possible signatures.
Right.
So that's a lot of data. Signature is like 30% of the data in a transaction already. So if you have to do that three times, you've doubled the size of your transaction.
Sure. So it's a lot of data, and it's
just
a,
to show
a data reveal as well. So it's like a privacy reveal.
Exactly. Exactly. That's another one of the benefits. But the first one is just in straight data savings is that you're using basically a Merkle root. You're just hashing those signatures together, the keys together, to create one signature at the end of it that is made up of those three or five or seven or 100. It doesn't matter how many there are.
So that's how the data gets obscured. It kind of
exactly.
Got it. Okay.
It's essentially a hash of all of the signatures that are involved, in a sense, which a signature kind of is a hash in and of itself, but you know, ignoring the kind of nit and gritty there. So you don't have to have all that data. So you could have something crazy like a 70 of 100 multi-sig and something like a company, some sort of business enterprise, and talk about dealing like in a major way with misappropriation of resources. If you can set up some crazy scheme where you have to have some threshold of people who all agree about how and where things are spent, and yet it doesn't cost you 100 times a normal transaction to do that. It looks like it could just as easily just be one transaction, just like anything else.
Right.
So it's a huge data savings from that side of things. But then, like you mentioned, privacy. Privacy is huge. And that's something that's like that I think is like crazy important, is the ability to selectively reveal oneself to the world, you know, to basically not tell any information unless it is explicitly relevant, explicitly necessary, and unless you want to tell somebody. And privacy is a state that we either have or we don't. Taproot is a great way on chain to begin to get some of that back. And that's in, you know, take for example, the business example I just said of 70 out of 100 keys is, if it looks like every other transaction, well, then nobody can spy on what that business is up to.
Right.
Or, you know, where those funds potentially went, or if it's even a business versus just a normal transaction from somebody random on the chain. It really begins to obscure a lot of that stuff, which I think is really key. Like, if this thing's going to be a global, like, monetary and payment system, there has to be a degree of privacy for it to not get, like, heavily abused in that way. Like, I think that's a super critical thing.
Sure. Especially as we want to build out more use cases. I think for people.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of the things that are coming to mind for myself are these future use cases. I kind of want to ask one about SHA-256. Like, what is that mm-hmm. to someone? You know, I understand that's the cryptography, but what were the other choices? And why did this one? I guess you're saying it's very, you know, it's known tech, it's old tech, but I mean, what were the other choices at the time? What function does it perform?
So there's actually like SHA-256 is ECDSA is the curve. I don't know a really great way to explain this. There are, what would have been the other ones? Actually, Schnorr, which is funny. Schnorr right. Signatures okay. is an alternative to SHA-256. That was actually available at the time, but it did not have quite enough of a history to really know it was secure. And Schnorr is actually a lot more adaptive. It doesn't have the restrictions, a handful of the restrictions that SHA-256 does. But it was also under copyright. The copyright on Schnorr had not expired yet. So I assume it was probably the copyright issue that had kept Satoshi from using Schnorr. But now that, you know, we can actually soft fork a new type of signature in Schnorr actually makes sense. And we've also had another 10 years of watching it, you know, being beaten to death and surviving. So
does that mean we're moving away from SHA-256, or they just get kind of integrated and built on top of each other, or some sort of synergy effect there?
You know, that's a good question. Like SHA-256 is still at the heart of so much of what goes on in Bitcoin, like the block hashes, the mining hash, like all of that stuff is still there. It's just the signature scheme. So I got to say, I don't know. I don't know the specifics on that well enough to explain it.
Sure. I another thing I'm kind of curious about is activation. As someone who just kind of wants to protect the network. The word activation, I get a little hesitant. What's going on here? Who gets to activate? How does that process work? And I guess there's different ways to roll out an activation, whether it's like a BIP 8 or BIP 8 or 9. So how do we move through that process and gain comfort with the new technology that's being implied and implemented?
Yeah, so BIP-9 had become the standard for a while, which was like one of the things you want is you want miners to upgrade because they're the ones extending the chain. So if somebody uses, like, let's say, like I use a Taproot transaction tomorrow, is that if there's only one miner that is upgraded to Taproot, well, then I have almost no guarantees about it staying in. Like technically I could use it nodes that weren't validating it would still accept it because again it's backwards compatible, but they wouldn't be able to verify the new information, the information that's critical that says I am the one who owns it. So potentially a miner could mine a transaction with invalid Taproot data. And my one Taproot node would say, oh, no, this is invalid. But everybody else would be like, no, it's great because they're not reading it. So they could basically, potentially like steal my coins, or they could screw up my transaction somehow. Like, you know, they could mess things up because nobody else is protecting me and my ownership of this new data that I'm putting into the chain.
Right.
So you want miners to adopt it, but you also need nodes to adopt it. So BIP-9 was an original standard of just like, okay, well, we'll just let 90, as soon as 90% of the miners upgrade, we'll just assume, or I think it's like, maybe it was 95% actually, I don't know, somewhere up there. After like a, you know, 1 year threshold or whatever, they upgrade. And after it hits this threshold, we get like a 2 week waiting period before activation, and then it activates and everybody's good to go. And this worked for a multiple soft forks up until a really contentious one, up until SegWit.
Right.
And suddenly it went from being the miners are just upgrading to, oh, the miners are voting on this. And it became politicized almost immediately when there was any kind of contention about this. And that was never the intent. There were actually a couple of developers, I can't remember who, were like, you know, somebody's going to think that this is voting and this is going to be politicized. And that was kind of like a subtle warning at the beginning there. And then it was kind of ignored for a while, and then it happened.
Right.
So the other way to quote unquote upgrade is by user activated soft fork, which is what happened with SegWit. And that is basically a kind of playing chicken with the miners if the miners are not going to upgrade. Because also, if you have all the nodes on the network, if you have as many people as possible who are invested in the network who are upgraded to this new software, well, then they're all protecting you from invalid data. So maybe you don't have that many miners, but you can basically But as soon as they try to create invalid Taproot data, well, they're kicked off the network as if they have hard forked instead of just soft forked. They might as well be on Bitcoin Cash at that point because all the nodes are checking their work and saying no. Right. So there's this delicate relationship between miners and validating nodes that they are basically at odds, in a situation where they're deciding whether or not to upgrade, they are. Validating nodes are the custodians of the current state and the current rules of the chain, and the miners are the ones extending it into the future. So user-activated soft fork was essentially a version of BIP-8. The miners, quote-unquote, vote, which wasn't supposed to be a vote, but the miners upgrade was BIP-9. So BIP-8 basically says, we're all going to install this, and in a year, it's just going to activate, period. And anybody who is running the client where it activates is going to be able to use it. So it's basically saying that if we get a dominant group of people who are upgrading, well, then everybody just needs to get ready that this upgrade is happening. It doesn't mean anybody has to use Taproot. It just means that they need to know that Taproot data is going to be coming into the chain.
Right.
So again, it's still a soft fork. And that's why I really don't like the politicization of it all. So I'm definitely more the BIP-8 route at this point.
Right.
Is just get it over and done with. And this one's not even contentious. So it's just set a date. You know, that this happens after it's merged and, you know, we've got it in a client, just be 6 months out. Let's just do this shit.
why do you think this one is not contentious in terms of, obviously there's benefits to it, but is there ever, I don't think the contention around the last one was ever around, effective code, but is there ever debate around whether the code is ready? Or is that just vetted long before we move to the point we're at now? And then who does the vetting? That's kind of what I'm getting at. So how do I know that Taproot will execute the way we all think it will?
Gotcha. Yeah. So there's just a really big developer community that has been yelling at each other and arguing about it for a very long time. In fact, this Taproot in particular had started on 3 years ago, I think. And the bulk of the code was done, and most of it's just been refining and testing and finding errors and correcting and simplifying. There were months where they argued about where to put one extra bit of information. I mean, it's amazing how meticulous some of the conversations get about it.
Right.
And actually, they found a way to actually avoid the bit altogether. So it was kind of great that they spent that long worrying about it.
Is the testing on the testnet, I'm assuming? And I'm wondering...
They never actually had... I don't think they ever actually did a full testnet, like a public testnet with Taproot, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was all just done on straight running code, between themselves and doing stuff. I don't think it was public, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that. But I remember there had been discussion about a Taproot testnet, but I don't think it ever came to fruition.
Got it. And how does Taproot, is there a lot of interplay with the Lightning Network? Will it help kind of give benefits there?
Yes. Yeah. So kind of one of the other reasons that Taproot isn't super contentious is it's only 500 lines of code, and it's really sandboxed within another piece, another place in the code where we just know how that box interacts with everything else. It is in the signature space entirely. Because of that, it's just really low risk. Whereas something like SegWit, the reason that one was so contentious is because it was really an argument about the direction of the future of Bitcoin. Whereas Taproot isn't really that argument. We've already settled on the direction. That was what 2017 was.
Right. The
Civil War. Now it's kind of how we go about that direction, I guess you could say. Or maybe in what steps. But Taproot, going back to the multi-sig thing and how it applies to Lightning, is every Lightning transaction is a multi-sig transaction, right? Like, or every Lightning channel, every time you open or close a channel to get on the Lightning. So it's a 2-of-2 multi-sig, and then it's got three branches. It's basically got a insurance clause and like execution clause, and then like your normal like just get out of the channel clause. Like basically, it's got three branches, three different paths that you can take, and that's essentially the honest path, the if only one person is there, and then the if you cheat me path. So that's kind of how the contract is written, and that's some chunks of data. And just like on chain naturally it's a 2-of-2 multi-sig. So you've got multiple signatures and you can easily identify what kind of transaction it is. So you can actually look at the Bitcoin network right now and just kind of analyze transactions, just go through and you can straight up count the number of transactions where Lightning channels have been opened. And then you can count the number where Lightning channels have been closed. And then you can just guess and be like, well, this is basically the size of the Lightning network.
Right.
Because all these channels are open and this is how many closed. You won't be able to do that anymore with Taproot, which is a little sad, honestly, because like one of our big ways to actually keep track of Lightning will disappear on us, but Lightning will go dark, which is actually kind of cool at the exact same time because it will start to really bring to fruition what some of the power of the Lightning network. But it basically makes all of those channel openings and channel closings look identical to any other transaction.
Right.
One key, one signature, end of story.
Maybe just to level set a little bit, like how would you describe the Lightning network to someone who's coming at it from Bitcoin but doesn't really know what Layer 2 is building out?
Okay. I would hope they had a foundation for how the internet works. Because it's actually shockingly similar. It's one of my favorite analogies is like Ethernet is a broadcast layer on the internet. Like if you just start plugging Ethernet cables into stuff, if you send out a message from a computer, it goes to every wire. Like it hits everything and it's just, you can just send out the broadcast layer and every computer receives it and checks if it's for them. And if it's not, they broadcast it on. So every single piece of communication on it needs to go to every single computer. That doesn't scale. So they didn't do that for very long. Then TCP/IP came about. And that was a way to basically keep a route of all the physical connections on the Ethernet network and be able to direct a message straight to its location and only through the three or four hubs, five hubs, whatever it is, to get there. And it was basically unpackaged like an address. It's like, okay, send it to the United States. Okay, send it to North Carolina. Okay, send it to the mountains. Okay, send it to this city. Okay, send it to this town, this street, blah, blah, blah. Like you like break it down into pieces. And that way you don't have to send it to everyone. I mean, imagine if your cell phone had to receive every single message from every person in the whole world just to figure out which ones were yours. Right. Obviously, it would fall apart in no time. Lightning Network is the TCP layer, is the routing layer of Bitcoin ownership. So where Bitcoin is a broadcast layer, every transaction you make is broadcast to the entire transaction. And to the entire network, and everybody who is running a node, mining, doing anything, will keep it and store it indefinitely. It is the broadcast layer. Lightning is the routed layer, the unicast layer, where you basically connect to it. You create a quote unquote channel, and that channel literally has an amount of bandwidth. It's just how much money you have in the channel, and then you connect to the Lightning network and then you send the money directly to the person and you don't have to broadcast it to the entire Bitcoin network.
Wow.
So it's literally a network on top of the Bitcoin network written into Bitcoin transactions. I hope that kind of gets the idea across. And but, it's really complicated.
Yeah, but I mean, you kind of broke it down real nice there. The things that come to mind for me when I get psyched about Lightning are micropayments, prediction markets, and something maybe like a paid for Twitter. Are these things mm-hmm. going to play out there? Are they playing out there? Because it just seems like we could build so much out of this second layer, and where does even maybe the third layer go?
Yeah. My curiosity there is just with, like, I think those things are possible. I think the major barrier to those are just whether or not it's economic. Is like whether or not people are going to pay every time they post, or you know, like how does that work from kind of the consumer mindset? And there needs to be either some sort of explicit trade-off or benefit that they're getting, or like Nick Zava has a really great piece on the, what he refers to as the mental transaction cost. It's called Minimizing Consumer Worry is the piece on his Unenumerated blog. And it's a really cool piece. And he just talks about how, like, you know, when you're talking about specifically microtransactions, is just the idea of getting someone to try to decide if this is worth 2 pennies or 1 penny is like too much, is stress that's worth more than 2 pennies. You know, like the right. just forcing someone to make that decision may be uneconomical just on its face, because it's, you don't want to have to make those decisions all the time.
Right. That's interesting.
I thought that was really fascinating too, just from the idea of like, how do you, could you hide it behind it? Because kind of part of that is maybe something like the Netflix model is like from a subscription standpoint, technically in Netflix, you're paying some, you know, mm-hmm. 20 cent or whatever for everything you watch, technically on average, but you're actually paying $15 a month or, you know, whatever it is, which seems a whole lot more reasonable and easier to make the decision about. And you do it once and then you just walk away from it.
Right.
So I wonder if something like that actually makes more sense. But like Sphinx is something that's really fascinating that I've been playing around with, and it does actually have a pay per message. It's basically a chat app, and they're creating like quote unquote tribes. It's something I'm actually playing around with, potentially having like a super like inner group of fans of the show to get together and like have like a $5 a month or something to get access to. It's everybody who's just playing with Lightning.
Right.
And then you can like have certain messages or certain episodes or special content or whatever that's behind like 100 sat paywall or something like that. And I mean, it's working right now. And it's pretty amazing, like some of the stuff that you can build with it. But that's the key, is as soon as you have the technology that will allow you to build those things, then you get to find out what's right. economical, what does work, what catches, what doesn't. And the beauty of Lightning is that you don't have any of these consensus problems. You don't have to worry about soft forks or hard forks or anything like this. Anybody can just make their own modifications. It's kind of like the internet. Anybody can make their website. They can make their own little quirk to the HTLCs, like how you lock up transactions in Lightning. And it doesn't have to apply by the same rules. You can put any kind of crazy smart contract or code or something you wrote in it. But you know, you just need to make sure that you're running, using it with somebody else who has the same client.
Right.
So that you're both speaking the same language. That's basically it. Just like I can have a website that only one person goes to. Well, I can have a Lightning service that only one person can use. So now we're actually in kind of like the web phase of Bitcoin development, where we have a payments layer, a network layer on top of it, where we do get this freedom to just code like crazy, to move fast and break things. And we don't have to threaten the underlying network to do it. The monetary policy is solid as a rock, even though we now have all this freedom to experiment.
Right.
That's super freaking exciting. And some of the stuff they've done recently, like Breeze Wallet and Phoenix Wallet, Strike, Fold. I mean, I've been using it constantly. I use it every day now. Multiple times a day. I think I did maybe 2 or 3 times today. I bought some crap on Fold. Just bought some wood glue on Amazon because I'm remodeling my closet. I mean, just anything that I can spend through Lightning. I mean, I just have that's the kind of the really fascinating thing about Strike is like it goes straight out of my bank account to Lightning. So like I can spend $20 from my bank account to a Lightning invoice, and I quote unquote paid in Lightning, and then on Fold I get like 4% back, so I just get a discount, and then I spend it on Amazon, and I didn't buy Bitcoin and then spend it. I just spent it as Bitcoin. Like Lightning Network was the payment rails that fulfilled my payment, and I got a discount for using that.
Right.
Which is just fascinating. Like I've earned almost 2 million sats just from using Lightning through my bank account in the same stuff that I would just normally do.
That's like $200.
Yeah. 200 and
something, 40 or maybe a little less.
Over time, sure. It's more just because it shot up 15% in the last 2 days.
But just
or three
to give people
days.
A reference, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice kickback. You know, for the guy that has read more about Bitcoin than anyone else, how did Bitcoin find you?
So my brother and I were living together. We were kind of dirt poor after college, just kind of hanging out. I was running a media business and like film production. I did like wedding videos, commercials and stuff like that. And I was enjoying it, but I think mostly I was just lazy. I was just kind of getting by and I didn't really know what the hell I wanted to do. But we would love to sit. He was majoring in economics at the time. And we would just love to sit down and just like break down the economic stuff. Like, I don't know how nerdy that is. Maybe that's like, that's like too far, but he would come home and he would be like, so they taught me this crap 3 days ago and they taught me this crap today. And literally these are polar opposites of each other. Like right. These two things cannot exist in the same world. And then we would just kind of like beat it to death. And then we would go on and watch some videos online. And I'm actually really crazy. We had an ongoing conversation with a guy named Warren Mosler, who is actually an incredibly prominent economist in the MMT field, which is ridiculous. We would kind of debate and talk back and forth with him. And then at some point through all of this, we found Austrian economics. And suddenly things were clicking. We started reading like Hayek and Mises and Rothbard and like all these things. And so, like suddenly like it was going back to first principles and things were really making sense. One of my favorite things to do, like kind of in a thought experiment, is to throw the money out of the equation altogether, because almost always it confuses the situation. And just ask what's happening to the actual resources. Like what's happening to the car that's moving from person A to person B. And you really start to see the story of what money's actually doing, what it means to counterfeit $1 trillion into the economy. No, it's not boosting things. It's just sucking resources from people who need it to somebody who's not doing anything for anybody else.
Right.
So we're like, we're kind of going down that rabbit hole, and that's leading us at the exact same time to like this heavily libertarian rabbit hole. And being a nerd, I was always fascinated with the internet and BitTorrent. And so, all of this was meeting all at once. And this was really kind of a perfect storm of, Bitcoin landing in our lap. And he was arguing with somebody on Facebook about like Austrian economics and stuff. And the guy just randomly said, you know, you would probably be interested or fascinated by this Bitcoin thing. And he's like, what is this? And so he immediately looked at it and then calls me over to the computer. He's like, dude, check this thing out. And we're like starting to read about it. And in a matter of minutes, it clicked. Like, it was just like, holy shit, like, this is fascinating. Because it's, you know, it's built like the BitTorrent protocol. And that was one of the first things that I noticed about it, was that it's a monetary system that's defended and is kept alive in the exact same way that BitTorrent's kept alive, is that everybody runs it. So there's nothing to shut down. And that was like the first thing that I was like, oh, shit. And then the monetary policy and the network, it's like the economics of the network is literally a codification of Austrian economic theory. It's hard, sound money. Nobody can cheat it. It doesn't change. It just is. And it's perfectly predictable into the future. So, like I said, like it was just like a perfect storm of like, holy crap, what is this thing? And that night, I remember we were just, I mean, it was like we were just completely stoned on this thing, like, right. like trying to figure out what this was. We were like digging into the white paper immediately. And there weren't like hardly any resources. This was like 2011. So, in fact, I was just talking to him about it. I think we figured out it was somewhere in June 2011. When we stumbled upon this thing, and it suddenly, like, we just realized the sun was coming up. Like, we had literally gone for like 8 or 9 hours, like no break, and had no idea. Like it was just the most engrossing thing that I had ever stumbled upon, and here I am. I've just not left. Like, that's kind of been like a constant stream of fascination with learning more about this thing and digging into as much content as I could possibly find about it. And, you know, 9 years later, I'm just, I don't know, now I read and talk about it more. I don't know how, but here I am.
Right. Do you think Bitcoin is like a religion? A lot of people, you know, I mean, I came to it. I just do it all day, every day. That's why I started the show. I just wanted to put all my time into it. There's just so many, you know, rabbit holes that it leads to. And I just find that it just provides a lot of, you know, truth for me in the world. Like Zen or Bitcoin is like a true north. Mm-hmm. And it has become like religious for myself. I want to tell everybody about it, get everybody on board. What do you think it is about it, or is it not like that for you? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Like, if you ask me if I have a religious fervor for it, absolutely, no doubt. Like, I'd be a lying sack of crap if I told you otherwise. But it really kind of depends on how you define religion. Because if we're just talking about, like, an ideology attached to something that I think has like an incredibly profound meaning, well, then yeah, I mean, absolutely. Because like the reason I'm fascinated by it is because of the impact I think it'll have on the world. And again, it's the codification of an ideology to me,
right?
Kind of from the cypherpunk concepts, the origins there is that This is about equal rights in a form that can't be cheated. That there is no authority that basically gets to decide when equal rights are there or who has what rights or who owns what thing. You either produce the key or Bitcoin doesn't care. And you can't undo, like, right. I mean, yeah, you can go and you can, you know, beat somebody over the head with a wrench until they give you the key. But they have to give you the key. Like, you still need the key. The key, like, Eric Kaysen, who I just had on the show, talks about Foucault's truth, where truth gives legitimacy, not authority. Like, we are coming from a society where authority equals right. legitimacy.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if it's the truth. It doesn't matter if it's right. If you are in the correct position of power, that is what the legitimate transaction, the legitimate ownership is, the person who has the authority. And we are in a separate system now. Now we have a system of ownership of rights in a money where that is no longer the case. There is no authority in the system and there's no way to contest it. You either have the key or you don't. Truth creates the legitimacy. You either answer the math problem or Bitcoin says, go suck it. Like, I don't like, you're not, what are you even doing here?
Right.
It doesn't care whether you're the president of the United States, whether you're the czar of Russia or what. It doesn't matter how many guns you have. Bitcoin requires the key, period. And that's a really profound thing. Like, that's not like a small, like, it is a subtle shift when you just kind of look at it in practice. But from a historical perspective, from like a political systems and like ideological perspective, like, that's world changing. Like, that's a world shattering shift at one of the lowest levels of how we structure a society. And I think it's really hard to overstate what kind of an impact that'll have in our future.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I have to think of it as more than just money, because money is not really something I talk to about with other people. I don't like to ask mm-hmm. people like how much they make or what they spend or how much they save. But I feel comfortable talking about Bitcoin with other people if I get the moment. But I think that's, you know, you bring up a lot of interesting points about this, the political system that Bitcoin creates. I don't think I want to use the word political, but you wrote an interesting tweet. The Bitcoin system is a codification of property rights external to state authority. It's the best chance for sustainable, widespread liberty we've ever had. I think it's a really powerful statement. But, you know, how do you maybe explain that to somebody who's used to the state providing those external rights?
If, you know, let's say, like, you have you know, $100 and somebody steals it from you, or there's like $100 in question or something, right? And you go to a judge and you present your case, and the judge is the one who decides. That authority is who decides who the rightful owner is in whatever situation. And in the interim, nobody owns it. It's just the state's holding it until the rightful owner is decided. And if for some reason the rightful owner is not the one in possession of it, the state comes in and steals it. But at the end of the day, and steals it and supposedly puts it in the hand of the right person, that actually doesn't happen, but, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, the enforcer is the judicial system and the guns of the state. At the end of the day in Bitcoin, it is the key. It's the keys. Like, it is the cryptography. And it's completely external to it. Like, you can write a contract with a fail-safe, with, you know, an entire set of clauses. You know, on the Lightning Network, like I said, there's an insurance policy, and there's a if somebody tries to cheat me policy. And we can settle. And Bitcoin is the court.
Right.
The Bitcoin network decides who the rightful owner is. And once it's in their possession, there's nothing anybody can do about it. Unless you can, you know, pick, like, you know, the size of a SHA-256 key, unless you can pick one random atom out of the entire freaking universe and you just happen to guess the right one, then, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. And therefore, you don't own it. You just don't have the key. And there's actually some really interesting pieces. They say you can't actually own Bitcoin. You can simply be the one who controls it, because ownership almost entails like a legality of it. Whereas Bitcoin doesn't care about the legality. Bitcoin cares about the key itself, like who actually controls it. So that's actually like an interesting argument. I don't know how I feel about it, because I kind of think of owner as being the one who is in control of it. I guess not necessarily the quote unquote rightful owner, but that is exactly what makes it fascinating, is that I can memorize. There's a story I told at the BitBlock Boom speech about a guy named Herman Francis Mark, and he's a chemist, and he was actually pretty famous for coming up with some a way to study polymers. I can't remember exactly what, but it was actually a really big deal. But he grew up in in Austria during the time of the Nazis. And he was the son of a Jewish father. And they came into Austria. And when he was kind of seeing the writing on the wall about, like, things were not looking good, he was not publicly telling anybody because he was scared to speak up. But he and his wife started buying platinum wire on the basically in the dark markets or in the black market, clandestinely, and was using his life savings to do this.
Right.
So he had, I think it was like about $50,000 in life savings, which is somewhere around, or 50,000 marks at the time, which was about $900,000 in today's dollars.
Right, maybe 10 million marks.
And
I'm making that up, but.
So they were buying this platinum wire, and what they did is they actually twisted it into coat hangers.
Wow.
And then his wife made little cloth covers to go over the coat hangers.
Wow.
And like straight up in the middle of the night, they put a Nazi symbol on the hood of their car, and they put like ski racks on the top, and just made it look like their family was going on vacation. And they stuffed all their clothes in the trunk on what looked like normal ass hangers. And they got the inspection at the border and left. Oh, this is just a family going to Switzerland for a ski trip. They peaced out. They left their jobs. They left their family. They left their all their friends. Nobody knew. They just peaced the hell out. And they managed to take their life savings with them, but only because they had this fancy, crazy trick that they used that they couldn't tell anybody about.
Sure.
It's not like everybody in the country could just be like, oh yeah, platinum wire, let's all make hangers. Right. Like the gig would be up after the second person did it.
Yeah. They encrypted their money with material goods.
Exactly. They encrypted their money with a process, a hidden process. Now everybody has a unique process.
Right.
Everybody in the world can memorize 12 words and be stripped naked in the woods and walk across the border and end up in any country on the face of the planet. And they still have, they could be holding $1 billion in their head. And there's no president that can stop it. There's no czar. There's no nothing. They own it because the Bitcoin network says they own it, and because they have the key. And those are the only things that matter. All the political authorities, all the corporations, all the structures, all the judges, none of that matters anymore when it comes to owning Bitcoin. And when you start seeing trillions of dollars move into a system like that, that is entirely external to political ownership. And there, we don't really have an alternative to that anywhere. Real estate is stuck in a jurisdiction. It's obviously completely at the disposal of how honest and fair your government is. Gold? How the hell are you going to move $1 billion in gold quietly?
Right.
You can't, you can fit maybe a couple thousand up your butt before, you know, you're before they're asking why you weigh 400 pounds.
You can't do it.
It's just Venezuela so powerful can't do it right from now, the context. So. Yeah, yeah.
England won't let them have that.
Are they? I hadn't even kept up with it. But
I'm pretty sure
the
Bank of England, you know, has Venezuela's gold reserves, or at least some of it. And Venezuela's like, can we have that?
Oh,
back?
That's right.
And
they denied it.
Yeah, the U.S. stepped in and said, "Yeah, it's not a good transfer for everybody here at the table." you know, I want to get to this thread, your pin thread. It's fire. It's brutal. I think, you know, for a lot of people who come up in the American political framework, this stuff is hard to hear. And I'm going to change one word, the first word, libertarians, to Bitcoiners, because I also think, forgive me there, but I think that for the sake of this conversation, libertarians distorts or distracts from how what we're going to talk about here is above politics. And it's not a left-right thing, and not a third party's going to solve it kind of thing.
I would say, and I use the libertarian term kind of loosely, because the vast majority of libertarians are not libertarians in my mind. Like the Libertarian Party, I think, is a joke.
Right, and that's why I don't want to use the word.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Right. So, but I'm not trying to change your writing, but I think we're on the same page here. So,
how dare you, sir?
So, Bitcoiners have literally called all this shit. Police won't protect you. Second Amendment. I think, you know, that's a hard one to talk about. I think, you know, I grew up where, in the mindset of the police will protect me. The Second Amendment was for hunters or, you know, people who don't live in the city. Kind of how did you come around to this, and how do you deal or explain this to people that are kind of new to that concept, who just think the state's going to be there for them?
Well, it's kind of funny. 2020 has made that much clearer than it probably ever has been. There's actually been, like, there was a case in New York. God, I don't even remember when it was. It was like, it was a while ago now. It's like 10 or 15 years ago. I can't remember exactly. But of a guy literally stabbing someone to death on the subway, and like everybody got off of it. And the officer who was there was too scared to get on the subway and do anything. So he just stood outside and let the guy get stabbed to death and just waited until backup showed up. And the guy died. And then they apprehended the murderer. And he was taken to court saying, you know, what the hell? You can't just stand there while somebody's getting killed. Like, you're the freaking police. Like, you were forced to pay you, damn it. Like, you're going to be at least be forced to do something with the money that we pay you and do your job. And the judge said, no, they don't. If they're at risk, they don't have to do anything. They can just stand there and watch you get murdered. Mm. And so they do not have a legal obligation to help you at all. And if they're scared at all, if they don't feel like they've outnumbered or outmanned who they're fighting against, they're just not going to be there. They're just not. And very well, they may be the aggressor. I mean, look at 2020 for any length of time. Like, what makes you think the police are the good guys? They're people just like everybody else. And maybe they are the enemy. I mean, look at defund the police and all this stuff. And it's funny, I actually came from a conservative background. So I was always kind of Second Amendment. But then I just kind of started looking at the realities of police brutality and like overreaches of power, and then kind of got into like how stupid the drug laws were and like the history there. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of clear that the police are just goons. Like, they're just people doing their job. And the morality, the extensive immorality of the law just puts them at odds. Like, they're just going to do what they're told. They're not going to look and be like, is this law evil? Am I doing like, are we the baddies right now? No, they're just going to do their job. And that job is very often to just be violent against people who are perfectly peaceful.
Yeah.
So they're not going to help us. Like, they're not something that we can depend on. And that's why you need a gun. You got to protect your keys. If you're dependent on somebody else to come save you when the shit hits the fan, then you're dependent. You're not independent. You're not sovereign.
Well, we kind of stopped on the first bullet there, so I kind of bastardized it a bit. I'm going to rattle through a few of these, and then we'll circle back. Yeah. So to continue, the media lies endlessly. Drug war destroys communities. More government power equals far worse consequences. Welfare destroys minorities. Redistribution is used against, not for, the poor. Police immunity is a recipe for totalitarianism. Centralized money is a weapon against the people. When the shit hits the fan, everyone protects themselves, especially authorities. Shutting down the economy will not save lives. Before we continue with the thread, I want to jump back to more government power equals far worse consequences. Because, you know, in the year 2020, I just see, you know, I think Adam Townsend called it in March the greatest roll-up of power in human history. I don't see that kind of backing down anytime soon, even though people have called this. Do you see it that way? Or do you see it differently? I think there are both sides of the coin. We have more tools at our hands with something like Bitcoin. But where do you think that's going, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think the shift from government power has to be a systemic shift. And that's why I think Bitcoin is the only realistic chance there. But also, government power relies on trust. It relies on belief in a coherent narrative as to what the government is and what the hell all of them are doing. They require us to believe that they are the good guys. And what's funny is that the internet itself has already broken a lot of that down. I talk about it actually is that I analogize it kind of to like we're living through the Great Disillusion, and where because of kind of the centralization and the very narrow scope of media, like go back to the 80s and stuff, like you had like your little circle of friends that you talked to and stuff, but you were basically exposed to ideas from like three channels on TV. And, you know, there was like one overarching narrative of what the country was, of what we were, and, you know, all this stuff. And now we just almost have like this endless supply of narratives. We have an unlimited number of sources of information and ideas, and things can go viral in no time. And it's as if for the longest time we believed a lie, but it was just a really comfortable lie. And now everything's been thrown into chaos because we've just kind of realized that most of it was a lie. And so we've bifurcated into like 1,000 different branches, and everybody's trying to find their own truth. But think about it from the context of like people hating Trump and saying like Trump is a Nazi, or, you know, all the SJW shit, and like the liberals don't think you should be able to say this whole list of words or wear certain clothes, depending, like, it's literally, it's like they want to just get like a whole list of like, what color of skin are you? Where are you from? This is the thing that you're allowed to do. These are the things you're not allowed to do. It's like, oh, great. We're back to that again. And like, so like both sides have just kind of gone batshit with it. It's like, well, if the government was in charge of less, would any of that matter? Like, it's because the government is doing everything. It is like nanny state into every single aspect of our lives. It determines our health care. It determines where we get educated. It determines whether we get any of these things. It determines our benefits at our jobs. Like, I mean, just they've involved themselves in everything. So now it's like a nightmare if somebody who doesn't agree with me becomes president. And now I have to hate somebody who is my neighbor, who might be a perfectly nice person in every other context, because, you know, they want a different healthcare plan than I do. And it's like, well, you should just be able to buy your healthcare plan and I buy mine. Like, what has happened that suddenly the government runs everything, so we're at each other's throats about the most mundane, idiotic things? And it's because the government has too much power. The government decides who the winners and losers in the economy are, who gets bailed out, and who pays the price. And it should be obvious, but I don't think people are learning the lesson. But again, I think it just feels like the end game.
Yeah,
like this is like rolling into all of this stuff finally unfolding, and when you get into that sort of a transition, it's kind of like the whole world's having an identity crisis, the country especially. And, you know, that's not comfortable. Like, people freak out and they scream and they cry and they hit each other.
Right.
you know, like, and I think that's going to happen. And I think we're seeing that. And I think it's probably only going to get a little bit worse before it gets better. But we actually have a systemic solution. And I think Bitcoin is right at the core of the problem and well, the solution, really.
Yeah. I waffle between whether we're going through the Great Awakening or the Great Reset to the Eyes Wide Shut. And
I do that same thing,
And
I
think it's irrelevant for myself as far as, you know, I just, you know, if there's a really bad field of soil and I don't want to farm there, I'll just go find another plot. And I'm not going to spend my whole life trying to fix this bad land, maybe. I do want to go full Bitcoin audible on you and read through this the rest of this thread, and continue this dialogue that you're putting out there, whether people are, you know, getting it or not or hearing it, and whether people agree. I think that, you know, it's a debate. So I'd love to get through the rest of this. This isn't white versus black. It's the state versus the people. Telling the truth will make you an enemy. The culture war will turn into a political one. Opportunists will grab every ounce of power they can when crisis hits. Speech is not violence, and when you equate them, violence will be excused. Debt destroys society. Stimulus is economic poison. The bailouts are the greatest theft in financial history. Hillary will be a terrible president. Trump will be a terrible president. Education didn't get cheaper by pushing lifelong debt on young, ignorant customers. Government worsened health care all of the thousand times they fixed it. The list is so long it could go for days. I never expect anyone to listen, but the willful blindness is staggering. All principles have been lost, the entire system, and culture is so full of contradictions now as to be an ideological blob with no shape or form. Logical consistency and self-restraint isn't even entertained anymore. And just to be thorough, Epstein didn't kill himself. It's a lot, dude. It's a lot of ideas, and you know, there are a lot of ideas that I've come to as a Bitcoiner, and I'm just so excited to have the conversation. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it. There are so many places to find you. I do recommend everyone check out Bitcoin Audible, Guy's Chats, Guy's Takes, GuySwan.com. I don't know if I've covered it all. Is there anywhere else we could find you, Guy?
The cryptoeconomy.com used to be the hub, but I've slowly moved away from that. So maybe GuySwan.com. But I'm also on YouTube now. I've just started getting my video up, and I worked on like a whole new intro that I'm kind of proud of. did the Michael Saylor interview is on YouTube if you want to watch
nice.
It. Which God, that was great. That guy's he knows how to make a man bullish. yeah, Bitcoin Audible and Guy Swan on Twitter and podcasts and YouTube. If you search Guy Swan, it all shows up.
Yeah, man. And everyone become a Patreon of Guy. This has been dope. I really appreciate it.
Hell yeah. Thanks, dude.
Yeah, man. Peace. Guy Swan literally calling all this shit right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dug the show, please vote with your thumbs and press those 5 stars. That's the best way to spread the word. This is said. Peace.